This jazz station, Jamal Ahmed, and the soul of jazz. That was music coming from the legendary Jeff Lorber and Jean-Luc Ponty. What a nice one right there, entitled King Kong. And we actually, I was very surprised when a program director came in and said, you know, you're going to be talking with Jeff Lorber today. And I said, okay, well, let's do this. And I'm so honored to have him back in the studio. Mr. Jeff Lorber, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me. I'm here. I'm in town for a couple of days with my friend John Messerschmidt, who's over here, who works for Yamaha Musical Instruments. And we're doing some clinics and some music stores. They have a new instrument that's coming out that I'm going to be demonstrating. So I'm glad that you could have me in. We could hang out and catch up and listen to some good music.
Yes, thank you so much. And of course, welcome, John. It's good to have you, sir. Step up to the mic, John.
Great to be here.
I know you don't do this normally, man, but step up to the mic, man, because we're going to talk to you and get some stories. Pull that microphone to you.
Yeah, sure.
So we can hear from you, man. Now let's talk about keyboards and the importance of a good keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And first and foremost, Mr. Lorber, you know, you are one of those guys that's really been a techie for many years. You have been about understanding those synthesizers and getting to the root of how they work and how to fix them and all that. Talk about your love. How did you get involved in synthesizers and what made you love them so much?
Well, you know, I guess I first started playing professionally, really, when I was living in Boston. I was a music student at Berkeley, and I joined a band. We were kind of playing around the area, and I think my first rig was basically a Fender Rhodes going through a twin reverb amp, and which were both very heavy, and we used to carry those all over to the clubs, all over New England. And then I saw a Mini Moog, another band that was playing at this club that we were at, and I just, like, my eyes got really wide, and wow, what's that? I want one of those.
Mm.
And so, you know, and then the whole era of the 70s, and the 70s in particular, and the 80s was a period where there was so many cool things coming out as far as musical instruments. Like seems like every year there was like a new innovation. You know, analog synthesizers were the first. And then, you know, then eventually you had computer chips that gave you sort of total control and a lot more options, which is what we have now. But there were a lot of steps in between, and you know, now it's real easy. You just get one of these instruments, and it's already got like tons and tons of great sounds in it, and you can just find the ones that you want. But back in the day, you would have to program it yourself. I even have some of those old Moogs that have patch cables, and you had to kind of like create on a modular synthesizer the sound. Which it's funny because that's actually having a resurgence too. There's people that are really digging that. Even now, too.
Well, I mean, because I'm a music head, and I study all those synths, and I understand the importance of someone who can really program them well, especially back then.
Mm-hmm.
Did it make it more personal when you were programming the synthesizers as opposed to those patches that were already pre-made?
Yeah, I mean, well, back in the day, you had to study it and you had to learn it. And I mean, it was the success of some of these incredible musicians, like when Herbie first came out with his, you know, Headhunters album and the sound that he was getting on the roads and using the ARP string ensemble, and then George Duke, what he was doing with a ARP Odyssey synthesizer with the soloing stuff that he would do, and then what Herbie would do with the clavinet. It's sort of like there were these hit records, and then of course Joe Zawinul was a huge, you know, as far as sound was concerned, and just that band, Weather Report, what they would do in the studio, just their whole approach to every aspect of music, including composition and the form and the way they orchestrated stuff and the great things that Joe Zawinul would do with those instruments. So that's kind of what would happen. Like, these hit records would come out with these sounds. It's like, whoa, what's that? How did they make that sound? And then all the musicians would want to try to figure it out, and they would want to buy one of those instruments. And that's what kind of fueled. And then, of course, the companies that made the instruments in the first place, if they made something that was popular, they would all of a sudden make a lot of money.
Right.
And so then they had money to do R&D and to kind of keep developing it. So that's what happened for a long time. It was like really a lot of fun for everybody that was involved in the development of music and in development of instruments.
Yeah, and it's always interesting when you look at the history of synthesizers, and it was really the jazz guys who were the guys on in the frontier, you know, handling of course, you had people like Bernie Worrell, and you had Stevie Wonder, and with the Tonto.
Yeah, Stevie Wonder was a huge influence because no one had ever heard like the sounds. I mean, the thing that's funny is you listen to those records now, and even to this day, some of those sounds and the musicality with which he used those sounds, I mean, are mind blowing. It's incredible. I mean, you can really go back to the Beatles and just listen to stuff.
Exactly.
Of the stuff that those guys did with even more limited, tools. But I mean, like when I listen to Pastime Paradise, Stevie Wonder, I listen to that string sound that he's using. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's unreal.
Is that a Yamaha? I think that's the Yamaha organ that he had at the time.
Yeah, the Dream Machine.
Yeah, because he was using that huge Tonto with Malcolm Cecil, which was like a spaceship almost. Matter of fact, I think Gil Scott-Heron actually had it on one of his album covers, the album 1980.
Right.
But I want to talk to you, John, about you meeting Jeff, because that was a very interesting story that you were going to start. And I said, hold that for our audience, because I want to hear it, because it extended into so many things. But talk about when you guys first met.
Well, we initially met. I was a big fan of his music in the late 70s, and I was living in Columbus, Ohio at the time, and I had finished college and was playing, and found that Jeff was coming to town one particular date. So I went down to see him, and I had just recently purchased an Oberheim OBX, which was their first programmable synthesizer. See, that's the first one that they had.
And it was polyphonic. See, the early synthesizers, you can only play one note at a time. Yeah. But Oberheim came out, and all of a sudden you could play four notes.
Four, six, and eight,
yeah.
I guess.
Wow.
So that was a huge...
So expensive, too. It was like buying a new car for me.
Huge advance.
Mm.
It was like buying a new car for me.
Wow.
It's like $4,400. So you put that in today's money, it's like... $25,000
or something.
Yeah. Wow. So I had this, and I was having some problems.
And Prince was one of the first guys. The sound of, like, a lot of the stuff that Prince was doing.
Was that Oberheim?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he, it's funny because the guy that fixes my gear in L.A. used to work with Prince, and I just heard a whole bunch of stories from him just recently.
I'm glad you mentioned that, too. We'll talk about that in a little while.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I want to talk about that, though.
Well, he was playing at the Agora Theater in Columbus, and I went down because I specifically, of course, I wanted to hear the band. And then I wanted to ask him questions about his Oberheim because I knew he was using it.
Mm.
And it was funny because typical Jeff, you know, He just cuts right to the chase, you know. I said, I'm having a trouble. He goes, well, here's what I did. You open up the lid. You go in on the oscillator boards, which make the sound of the synthesizer. They're having a little tuning wheel on there. I just took a little nail polish and put on there. Now, just do that, shut the lid, and play it.
which basically meant it's not going to really stay in tune perfectly, but don't let it bother you. Yeah.
But you MacGyvered it, though. Wow, okay.
And then I met him. I went to work in Los Angeles for Yamaha a couple years later, so it was now we're up at 1982, and I was at the NAMM show working the show. Jeff comes by and says hey to me. We, you know, recognize one another. And he said, boy, I really need to get a new CP70. Now, the CP70 was the first portable grand piano. It was a grand piano that had strings, only it was very small, and it was in two halves. And you had to put these two halves together, but you could take it on the road with you.
Mm.
And it, you know, it was pretty stable. It would, you know, it could go a couple gigs and still stay in tune. And Jeff used that for how long did you use it?
Quite a few years.
Yeah.
Well, because back in those days, like now, you can get instruments that have really good piano sounds, but back then you couldn't. It didn't really exist.
Yeah.
So if you really wanted to get an authentic piano sound, if you went somewhere that didn't have a piano, you weren't going to be able to have that. So this was like sort of a solution to that problem. It was a little bit of a heavy, large thing to carry around, and you did have to tune it. But it was really a fun instrument, actually. And like a lot of these instruments that sort of came and went, all of a sudden there's like a new market for it, and people are still, like now, a lot of these vintage instruments are in demand, and they're much more valuable than they were when they were new.
Yeah, and it always seems like you can get a special sound from that one instrument as opposed to that synth that tries to carry the sounds that synthesizer
Yeah, what happened was, is like, people are always like, well, okay, well, that was last year's thing. What are they doing now? Do they have something better, you know? And then so people just, whatever they were playing, they just kind of let it go or they sell it.
Mm.
And then later you come back, it's like, wait, you know, that sound was just incredible. Like, why do we, you know, kind of, why aren't we still playing that instrument? Actually, what happened to me that really made the difference was I went over a friend of mine's house, and he had a Wurlitzer, and I sat down at the Wurlitzer, and I played it, and I couldn't believe how cool and how soulful it sounded and how cool it was. And that's when, that was probably in the early 90s, and that's when I just really, you know, the light bulb went off, and I got really into vintage keyboards, and I started collecting them and using them. And that's something that's pretty common. I think a lot of musicians now understand that those older instruments like the Fender Rhodes and the Mini Moog and the Wurlitzer have a fantastic sound that still can't really be beat in any ways.
But it's nothing like the...
I found the OBX.
He's going to the music stores all the time, so he's helping me out.
I find stuff all the time.
But it's nothing like some of the newer boards, though, because you're getting sounds and patches that you wouldn't get from anything else but that board. Let's talk about the Montage. What is it about?
Well, going back to this time in history, Jeff, we were now coming out with a new type of synthesis called FM. That Yamaha got together with Dr. Chowning up at Stanford University in California, and they started developing this new synthesis around FM, frequency modulation. Jeff and I were there in Los Angeles together, and I would, since it was one of the biggest markets at the time, we were doing the first versions of the FM were the CE20. Do you remember the CE20? DeBarge, you played it on the DeBarge record. Rhythm of the Night.
The GS something. Or
well, oh, yeah, the GS.
Wait. You said DeBarge, Rhythm of the Night?
Yeah.
You played on that record?
Yeah
I arranged
the,
that.
And that song.
That was like the first thing that I got when I first moved to LA. That was like one of the first jobs I got. And man, it was.
Because that's a serious keyboard song.
That's the CE20 that I had sent to me. I took it to him, and he used that on that record. That was the first FM portable synthesizer. We had the big GS, which like Toto used on Africa. You hear some of that on Africa, that record. And then we came out with the DX7, which was the kind of the final evolution of that series.
And you guys sold a lot of those, right?
Oh, yeah. That's very popular.
So
very
still
popular
around,
keyboard.
People still use
them. I still
see today.
People at gigs playing that.
Yeah. And, it was an unbelievable time for me because we couldn't build them fast enough. So this new Montage, well, after FM, everybody started going to sampling. Even Yamaha. So we now are taking both of those, sampling, our advanced wave memory sampling technique, and our new FM, which is much better than the FM that was there in 1982 and 83, bringing them together into Montage. So you get this blending of these two technologies, and it's really, really high fidelity, and it's sounds we've never heard before.
Wow. And are the tones, like some of those tones, giving you that warm analog feel as well?
Oh, yeah. So you get the warmth.
I've just been using the Montage in the studio for the last couple of weeks, and it just the sound quality is so great that it's just fun. It's just so much fun to just play anything off of it almost. It just sounds fat. It's got a cool sound.
Wow. So you are here, Mr. Lorber, Jeff Lorber. And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with legendary keyboardist Jeff Lorber and John Messerschmidt, who's the district manager for the Southeast for Yamaha. We're here talking about some clinics as well.
Yeah.
That you're going to be leading.
Talk
about those clinics tonight.
Yeah, tonight we'll be at Ken Stanton. They're all Ken Stanton Music here in Atlanta, so it's easy for everybody to find a Ken Stanton location. We'll be in Alpharetta tonight from 7 to 9. Tomorrow night we'll be in Stone Mountain at Ken Stanton. Stone Mountain from 7 to 9 there as well. And finally we'll be in Marietta on Thursday evening.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and of course, you know, one of our biggest customers now is the church market.
Ah, yes.
Huge, huge church market.
They make good music, too.
Yeah.
So that's why they need good music.
But a lot of the cats are coming out of the church. A lot of the cats who are playing Fusion are coming right out of the church.
Incredible stuff coming out of the church. Especially... I like to say in Atlanta because a lot of great music.
We got a lot of great musicians here.
A lot of great musicians here. And they all are familiar with the motif. So they really need to come out and try the montage.
All right. All right. Now, Mr. Lorber, I just want to ask you a few more questions.
Sure.
And you were talking about Prince, and sadly, of course, we lost one of the greats this year, Prince. But listening to his music, I noticed how he really changed the sound of the 80s with how he championed synthesizers and replacing horns with synthesizers.
Yep.
Talk about what you kind of saw in him.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you about the story about it was in the early 80s, and we were playing in Minneapolis, and we had a day off. And I wanted to rehearse the band because we had to learn some new music, and I was looking for a place to rehearse, and I called up this friend of mine who happened to work with Prince, and he got us into Prince's rehearsal room to rehearse because I guess Prince wasn't using it that day. And so I got to see the equipment that Prince was using. And he had these Oberheim synthesizers that were going through Marshall amps. Marshall amps are guitar amps. Like, normally, you would never think of running one of these synthesizers through a guitar amp. But I turned it on, and I played it, and wow, it sounded unbelievable. And so, I mean, you know, that was just the Minneapolis sound. It just kind of took over music for quite some time. You know, but and a lot of the characteristics are just what you just said, where you had synthesizers that took the place of horns and the use of drum machines, but also of a lot of live instruments. And, you know, I mean, what can you say? The guy was incredibly talented, a great writer and a wonderful musician. He could play keyboards beautifully, could play guitar great. I mean, like his first record, he played every instrument. He played drums and an incredible writer and so yeah, that you know, I think you know it's funny because unfortunately we've lost a lot of musicians over the last year or so, but this is one that really hits people because people knew how dedicated he was to music and to his craft and how serious he was about it. I mean, if you ever went to a Prince show, there was no show like that. It was just so well rehearsed, and you know, everybody played perfectly and everybody did their choreography perfectly. It was very entertaining musically. It was on point. And so I think that's one reason why his death just hit so, people so hard, because nobody was expecting that, and that we were all hoping that, you know, we'd have many years of Prince music to come.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what, Mr. Jeff Lorber, I'm going to get out of here and play something of yours, and I'm going to go back. And this is still a huge hit around here, and of course, with the young people automatically get this. So I'm going to play Rain Dance off classic album Water Sign, recorded in '79. Talk about the boards you played on this particular track.
Well, back in those days, that was before I really had a lot of money to afford very many instruments. And the studio that we worked at, it was actually a 16-track studio, and the only effect that we had was they had a reverb plate. It's like called an EMT plate, which is a really nice reverb, but it only has one sound and that's it. Or there was like a delay. I think you could create tape delay from one of the tape machines that was, you know, you could use that as a delay. So it was very limited, but I think we had a, I had an Oberheim 4 voice, which was one of the early four voice polyphonic synthesizers. And that's, I think that's why it has just that cool sound. There's just something really special about it. Of course, Freddie Hubbard played on the song. And, yeah, this is sort of my biggest hit because it's been sampled and it's been used on a lot of hip-hop records, Notorious, Big and Lil' Kim being, you know, the most well-known one, Crush on You, but also, you know, Jay-Z, Erykah Badu, and a few others.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of your music is still utilized by so many different people. But God bless you in all your future endeavors.
We
thank you so much for having us, for having you, actually. And John, if people want to find out more information about these clinics, where can they go online?
Okay, go to kenstanton.com.
Uh-huh.
And they'll be listed there. And we're giving some stuff away, too. We're giving away a little recording mixer. So we'll have those to give away. And we'd love to see you out there.
All right, all right.
Thank you for having us.
No, thank you all for coming down. God bless you on everything. This is Rain Dance coming from the man, Jeff Lorber, right here on The Soul of Jazz.